And he smacks one to deep right center field. Back goes Johnson at the wall, and it's out of here! A grand slam for Francisco Lindor! He was in the driver's seat, and he drove it right out of the ballpark. His seventh career grand slam, his 26th home run of the year, and it's 5-0 New York. And the Mets take full advantage of Machado's miscue to score four unearned runs on one big swing by Lindor. He slams this one to left, Profar back, and it's out of here! Francisco Lindor has homered from both sides of the plate, burnishing his MVP credentials with every swing. It's 6-1 New York.
The game of baseball is such a team game, but every once in a while, a star will take it over, and that's what Lindor's done tonight.
Carlos, what's your main takeaway when Lindor puts together that type of a game in all facets, offensively and defensively like that?
I mean, we're witnessing greatness here, you know, one of the best players in the game. And I think a lot of times people take for granted how good of a player and, you know, what he's able to do day in and day out. Not easy, you know, and not only offensively, but the way he plays a premium position, you know, shortstop, and the way, you know, he plays the position, what he means to the team, to that locker room, into the organization. So, unbelievable night against, another good pitcher. For him to get that huge hit, the bases loaded, to pretty much break the game there. And then, you know, from the right side against another tough arm that they have, pretty impressive.
We're back. So Francisco Lindor has been putting on a show this year, especially after the putrid start he got off to in April. And now talks of MVP have come up. And that's amazing considering, and I know that it's a different league, but the kind of season. I mean, Aaron Judge, legitimately, with the kind of power he has, it's probably going to break his own American League record for home runs. And I don't think he's going to hit 73 home runs or break Bonds' record this year. And I think as you get deeper in the year, especially when you play teams in a pennant race with that Yankees lineup, even with Soto being his, you know, the whole Batman and Batman. I don't think it's really Batman and Robin, Batman and Batman. I think it's going to be harder to walk them, but you can still navigate that lineup a little bit and get things done without pitching to Judge. It'd be interesting if he's in a better lineup with better protection. I'm sure he'd still get walked, but maybe not to the same case. But what Judge is doing is amazing. Bobby Witt Jr. And look, I know he's just a DH and he's not pitching this year. If he was pitching and producing at these offensive rates, it would be even more incredible. But what Ohtani is doing, on pace to be the first 50-50 player, is incredible. So Lindor being in the same conversation, especially with what you've seen with Judge and Ohtani, where you think of MVP, because MVP a lot of times has been the offensive award. The fact that he's even in that conversation shows you how good he is. And now a guy like Jeff Passan or at ESPN, and usually the national media just really in their wheelhouse, in their playbook, is Mets bashing or throwing cold water on anything good Mets. The fact that he's jumped in with an article talking a little bit, and I retweeted it over on X yesterday, it tells you that something special here is going on. What I really think struck me, and I think it goes back to the leadership part, because that's been a debate, and I don't want to, because those who've listened to the show a long time know the tired debate and the tired conversation that we've had. It was, hey, Mets made this trade, have no problem with the trade, have a problem with signing him to that big deal before they had a chance to watch him play, and maybe they thought they were getting somebody. What they thought they were getting in the offseason of 2020 into 2021 is the player we've seen now. We haven't seen this version consistently throughout his tenure. His first year was rocky. Every season he's had ups and downs to a certain degree. And there's always that feeling that Lindor is good, but not very good or not great, and not necessarily worth the money, the elite $35, $36 million per year, big contract that, you know, is going to be dwarfed over and over and over again since he signed it, since the market has changed with elite talent. But that fact remains that nobody's really felt, and even up to this week, you know, mainstream WFAN and those who follow the team in the media, there are still those who feel that Lindor, and maybe not those who cover him day in and day out, the beat guys, but those in general that cover the team, especially from the talking heads perspective of the landscape, I understand it in a lot of ways because fans feel this way too. A lot of the fans I talk to feel this way. He just doesn't feel like that type of player. He's very good. He's having a great year. He's coming up big and he's dominating games like you saw on both sides of the ball. The defense has always been there. The only knock about his defense is his arm, but even with not the strongest arm in the world, he finds a way to get it there with enough time so he knows how to play the position. I mean, he is the best defensive shortstop in Mets history. He's every bit as good as Ordóñez. The big difference between the two, Ordóñez was flashy and had a really good arm. I mean, maybe you got to give maybe Ordóñez the jump because of the arm, but Lindor knows how to play the position, and he knows how to make things happen there. And then obviously there's no comparison on the offensive side, but the leadership part and the things that kind of push you into captain status, let's talk about that, because the Mets don't have a captain, and maybe that's kind of a New York thing, because I was thinking about that after the Knicks made Jalen Brunson a captain recently. But when Ron Darling, who's been around the game as long as he has played with great players like you mentioned, like Hernandez and Carter, McGuire, Konsenko, and talks about Lindor in the pregame yesterday with the reverence where he's never seen somebody take on this kind of role with the team and dominate and do the things he's done and show leadership in that facet on both sides of the ball. And when you read the Passan article about how his style, which is very conversational, constantly talking around to people, being this kind of like upbeat personality. And I remember his first spring training, that was the one thing that a former Met told me who was down in the spring when I spoke to them, said the guy is always communicating on the field. Always communicating. But we know, I mean, because of the contract, because of the downs that have gone on with him on the offensive side, the thumbs down, the struggles of the team, and the fact that he's kind of been the poster child for the Cohen era, where it started with a bang and with bluster and with a lot of money being spent, but the return on that spend, that return on everything, hasn't matched the hype. Now it finally is. And then you think of this town, like, why does this town feel that Lindor is not a leader or maybe quite an MVP? Because when you think of those who have been in that pantheon, and I guess it's maybe two conversations. MVP, which is a data-driven award a lot of times, which shouldn't be. It should be more nuanced to it. But when you think of great leaders, off the top of my head, in any sport from this town, you think of Mark Messier, maybe the ultimate leader, Keith Hernandez, Derek Jeter, Willis Reed. You want to put Jalen Brunson and what he just recently did with the Knicks into that conversation? Sure. All of those guys are very similar, intense, stoic. They're not this gregarious, smiley, camera personality. Maybe Gary Carter was. But even Gary Carter on the field was an intense player. Like, Lindor is intense, but I think his intensity comes out more with him showing the joy. He's more of a showman. He doesn't have that, they used to call Keith Hernandez the Prince of Darkness. Sometimes being a leader has this level of intensity that you look at them and you wonder, does anything permeate these guys? Lindor is not that guy. He's out there, and you would think you're watching a kid play sandlot baseball, having a good time on a Sunday afternoon. And I'm not criticizing it. I think it's part of a different type of leadership. Because to us in this town, leadership is associated, in my opinion, with a lot of stoicism, with a lot of intensity, deep intensity. And there's different ways of being intense. The one thing about Lindor, which is even in his down years, that has shown me about his leadership has been he posts up every day, doesn't want a day off, and he's out there. I mean, did he fracture his finger in the closet in the hotel a couple of years back in 2022? He missed one game, never told anybody, played through injuries last year that would have sidelined some others, didn't use it as an excuse, didn't tell anybody. I mean, he's there. He's posted up everything. I mean, you basically have to, I mean, that guy has to be on his deathbed not to come out and play shortstop. I mean, Mendoza was talking a little bit about it, I think, with the press saying, hey, when I ask him, does he need a blow? Does he need a day off? He says, yeah, Monday. That's today. That's the scheduled day off. And to me, the more that we go through this Lindor saga, the more you got to like the guy. The more you have to say, this early first 10 years, first decade of Cohen ownership is really going to be defined by the acquisition of Lindor and Lindor being kind of the focal piece. And in a lot of ways, similar to A-Rod, in not the same negative way, especially with the narcissism and the off-the-field stuff, Lindor is going to be this polarizing figure. Not Pete Alonso. It used to be we thought with Pete Alonso. Pete Alonso is becoming more of a secondary act, or McNeil, guys like that, you know, Vientos. I mean, Lindor is going to be the face of this franchise. I mean, think about it. Who was he working with this offseason? Vientos and Beatty, on his own time to work with them on their defense. Both have shown tremendous strides on that side of the ball. You got to give Lindor some credit on that. And maybe he's a little goofy. He doesn't take himself too seriously, which doesn't tie into those names that you heard earlier. Those leaders, those great players that have obviously, with the exception of Brunson, won a championship here in this town. But it works. And it seems like he's loved in that clubhouse. And it seems like it's something that all of us have been wrong about. Now, as far as an MVP, that's a more difficult conversation because I think in the National League, the writers in the BBWAA that have the privilege of voting for MVP, they got themselves a tough one this year. Now, in the American League, I think it's going to be pretty easy. It's going to be Judge, although I think Bobby Witt Jr. is going to give some people something to talk about, to think about when it's all said and done. But, I mean, the kind of season that Judge is having, the fact that he's probably going to break his own American League home run record makes it pretty hard to see how he does it win the MVP. And Soto, the fact that the Yankees have made this great turnaround just by his presence and how that lineup has been so bad at times, the fact that Soto has been able to, almost with Judge, be like the baseball version of an NBA team, carry the offense. I mean, he should be put into that conversation. Then you have Gunnar Henderson. So you got some great conversations in the American League. The National League, it's a little bit different because it's really what it comes down to. It's going to come down to Lindor and Ohtani, unless either one of those guys falls off a cliff. And even if Ohtani fell off a cliff, he's still going to be getting plenty of votes. I think it really comes down to an interesting debate about the designated hitter because Ohtani and the Dodgers are going to make the postseason. It's pretty, astonishing if they didn't. So they've already got one check that I can't guarantee that Lindor, even if he continues to play at this rate, that the Mets make the postseason. Now, if the Mets make the postseason, I think the debate is a little bit different because Lindor took a team, ironically, that was beaten up by the Dodgers and Ohtani back in late May and was ready to shoot themselves into the abyss. Lindor is going to be taking that team to the postseason. I think that doesn't negate the outstanding numbers that Ohtani has, but it's something that should put a little bit of a gold star in his column because Ohtani's team is supposed to make the playoffs even without Ohtani. They made the playoffs. They were a great team without Ohtani. Ohtani coming in just made them that much better. So you look at Ohtani, you look at the numbers he's putting up. He's putting it up as a DH without pitching and no fielding, nothing in the fact that he leads or is right there. I shouldn't say leads. He's right there with Lindor on wins above replacement. He's at 6.3. Lindor's at 6.5. Who's playing? He's at 6.3. Lindor's at 6.5. Lindor's playing a gold glove caliber shortstop is amazing. This guy is going to go 50-50. And it was funny because I was thinking, you know, nobody's ever come close to 50-50. Konsenko didn't do it in 88. Bonds should have done it at some point because he had the talent. When he was hitting late 40s home runs before he steroid up, he wasn't running at that level. But he was a 40-40 guy. The one guy who nearly did it and probably could have done it if he didn't fall off the cliff offensively is Alfonso Soriano. Everybody forgets how good he was as a home run hitter. And he almost did it in Washington in 2006. Came up short on both, but you know, within 10 stolen bases and within five home runs of 50-50, that's pretty incredible. And that was during a time where you didn't have the rules like you had today. So Ohtani doing this 50-50, even with the compromised bigger bases and the pickoff rule, it's still amazing. Because even with the rules helping the runner, it's not like people are running wild. Stolen bases are more normalized than back to maybe how they used to be 25 years ago. It's not like all of a sudden stolen bases have taken a turn historically to a level we haven't seen before. Not yet, anyway. You never know what happens. But it's going to be hard for Lindor if Ohtani hits 50-50. And because of the LA aspect and the fact that it's the Dodgers and it's Ohtani and the international appeal and the fact that he has that prior MVP cachet and he has that name, he was that big free agent fish, it's going to be hard for the national media to vote for Lindor over him, especially if the Mets don't make the playoffs. Now, if the Mets make the playoffs and Lindor continues, and it looks like he's going to have another 30-30 season, not 40-40, that would be the next step. Not going to happen this year unless he goes wild. You know, it's going to be hard for him to get that recognition, but I think now, as Mets fans and those that cover the Mets, maybe we need to put aside our debate about the value of Lindor and the greatness of Lindor, and just accept him for who he is. A really good defensive shortstop, a Gold Glove level, a guy that is going to produce, at least in his prime, 30-30. And whether he does it in the middle of the order or at the top of the order, that doesn't matter. He's producing it. And a guy that's going to have a different energy and vibe with the way his leadership style is, which is going to be more happy, is the word I would say. He's not going to be this intense Prince of Darkness like Hernandez. He's not going to be stoic and single-mindedly about winning the World Series like a Derek Jeter. He's not going to be like Mark Messier. You know, he's not going to be the best player maybe in baseball where there's that feel where his numbers pop out at you, but he does a lot of things well. I mean, he's up there since 2015 when he came up. There's only a couple of players who have more value based on Fangraph's war. And that's Trout and Mookie Betts. He's top five in the league. And I know you're saying to yourself, it doesn't feel that way. Sometimes I feel like maybe we, because all of us, those who are in their late 40s and younger, grew up in video game era numbers, whether it be the NFL and the NBA and the steroid era in baseball. Sometimes I feel like we need to see video game results from a player consistently to have them feel like they're elite. The kind of season Lindor has been putting up, and quite honestly has put up since 2022, and even to a certain degree late 2021, these are seasons that would be elite in the 60s and 70s in baseball. And we're not talking like that was the dead ball era. I mean, let's say post-mound change, even the 80s. Shoot, before steroids, probably was a pretty damn good season in the early 90s. So really, at this point, a couple of things you got to walk away with is that this is Lindor's team. And those who are coming into it are going to be coming into Lindor's team. I don't think it's Nimmo's team. It's not Pete's team. You can't give it to a pitcher. It's not Diaz's team. This is Lindor's team. Lindor is the face of this team. He's the guy that, when you come here, he's the guy that you're going to go over to his locker first. I know people are talking about Nimmo. I think Nimmo's more of that quiet, steady, maybe stabilizing guy. Lindor's the guy that right now has shown since Memorial Day, he'll put the team on his back. I mean, basically, he won a game for them on Saturday night. Yeah, Peterson pitched well. Baseball's not about one guy. This is not Michael Jordan here. But on the offensive side, he took advantage of some miscues, and he popped the grand slam that won the ball game. And yesterday, he had a chance early to put a crooked number up. He didn't come through. But look, it's baseball. He's still, even the best hitters, even on Ohtani's, are going to fail 70% of the time. And now he's getting national recognition. Now, where is this season? Now, here's the other discussion that we had here and made me think. Where does this season play in terms of the all-time Mets seasons? Because I thought about that. I thought about that as we were as I was watching the game, I was thinking about this segment, because once everything happened with Lindor and the discussion about Lindor, I knew that we'd have a segment about him. And I don't want to do the same boring, you know, getting, you know, married over coffee. We've had those conversations. We know we didn't like the process of signing him. He's been through a lot. Earlier in the year, when he was struggling in the first couple of months of the year, you thought, oh my God, this guy's never, you know, this guy was miserable here. He talked about when he went to Cleveland, how he misses winning. He talked about almost like he was putting an SOS out to Cleveland, said, get me back, take me back. I regret this. You wonder, did he regret even signing here? Yeah, he got paid. He could have got paid somewhere else. But it's interesting, like, ever since that time, the guy just took the team on his back, said, screw it, and has exemplified everything that you'd want on the offensive and defensive side. Now, when you look at all-time Mets seasons, and you just use baseball reference, you want to use wins above replacement, you know, names like Piazza and Hernandez and Strawberry's near MVP season and Kevin McReynolds and Carlos Beltran and David Wright and guys like that. And, you know, ultimately, when you look from a statistical standpoint, the best all-time season, when you factor it all in, especially with both sides of the ball, for a Met is the 2007 David Wright season. And I think people don't remember, and it was interesting because the Mets choked down the stretch in 07-08. Wright got kind of the choking label back then. It shows you how data and what's in front of us sometimes gets overclouded by emotion. We talked about that earlier. David Wright got the choking moniker because of that. Meanwhile, that's the best all-time Mets season. I mean, nearly 1,000 OPS. Talk about 30-30 season. Gold glove level defense at third base. I mean, that's when you thought, hey, this guy's headed for a Hall of Fame stretch. We know what happened. Beltran's 06 is actually the year before, a shade below. Those are the two best seasons. And ironically, the 06 season with Beltran, everybody remembers the curveball, the elite Hall of Fame curveball. And there are others that are in the top five, the Gilkeys, the Lance Johnsons, the John Olerud's in 98, when nobody could get him out down the stretch. He went 13 times in a row getting on base by a hit or a walk. And of course, you have Gary Carter when he came over in 85, and Strawberry's 88 somewhere in there and things like that. But nobody has done better than the Wright Beltran in the back-to-back years, how they carried that team, you know, 1 year getting to the Game 7 of the Championship Series, the other year a severely disappointing loss. Goes to show you in baseball, it's not like any other sport. Even David Wright's elite down-the-stretch performance on both sides of the ball and historic Mets season wasn't enough to overcome bad starting pitching and bad bullpen. I mean, that just goes to show you. Now, Lindor, through today, and I did some back-of-the-paper bag math projections, I project him to be about a 7-win player on the baseball reference algorithm by the end of the year. 7-2. You know, he's going to fall potentially in the top five if he continues at the same pace. He'll be right there at the top five seasons in Mets history. Wright 07, Beltran 06, Gilkey 06, Olerud 98, Lance Johnson 96, with 2012 Wright and 1969 Cleon Jones right outside of that. And Lindor is going to fall, if he continues, right there. So this is not the best season in Mets history by any stretch of the imagination. But certainly, forget about what the numbers say. What Lindor has been doing, especially since Memorial Day, has been doing something similar to what we saw Carlos Beltran do in 06, Wright do in 07. And this is the funny part about Mets history and being a Mets fan and covering this team. Those players I brought up, I mean, Wright is looked at way more with a level of reverence post-career ending injury and retirement than he was when he was in his prime. He was criticized a lot. Beltran was murdered here because of Game 7 and Wainwright. Murdered. He never really recovered from a perception standpoint. Meanwhile, those are the two best seasons in Mets history, and the blueprint of how they went about, even how things ended poorly in both of those seasons for, you know, a variety of reasons, those are the blueprints of greatness. And you're going to put Lindor in there, and guess what? Guys like Wright were considered a leader. Beltran, I don't think, was looked at by the media as a leader, but he certainly was a leader on that team, especially to the Latino contingent. And similar to Lindor, I think a guy that just went out there and played every day and did his job at an elite level. And of course, Beltran has shown those leadership capabilities in retirement with some of his work in the front office. And he was the manager of the Mets for a hot minute, and he's actually back with the Mets. It also makes you wonder, and you know, maybe this is, you know, a third rail when you talk about it. Is it because of, you know, a lot of times I think in this sport, Latino players have not necessarily been looked at as leaders because of their style of the joy for the game. And maybe the fact, like I said earlier, when you compare them to American-born players like Willis Reed and Jalen Brunson and Jeter and Messier and Hernandez and Carter, they have a different way of enjoying the game. It's more of a joyful approach. This is not about race. I'm not trying to get into race here. I'm trying to talk about how a certain subset of the population approaches the game. And it's a cultural thing. And maybe that as a society in our history, in the American side of the sports, how we look at things, maybe we are a little clouded by that. That's why when you see a guy like Lindor, you kind of say to yourself, is that really a leader? Does he feel like a leader because of his personality? Because he's got this goofy smile. Is it phony? I mean, I know some people have said that. In the end, the only thing that matters, it's not what I feel about Lindor's leadership or what you feel about Lindor's leadership or Jeff Passan or Joel Sherman or any of the beat writers. It's what the guys in that clubhouse think. And you've never heard a negative thing come out of that clubhouse. Nothing leaked, nothing. And really, I mean, ever since he got off to a bad start, and let's face it, the reason for a lot of the disenchantment with Lindor has been because of the frustration of how the team has performed, which is way bigger than just Lindor and the money. Let's remember, money and how you pay somebody plays into it. That's really, I think, a lot of the arm's length that the fans have had, that the media has had. Now, the chips are into the center of the table. The stakes are raised. Lindor now, as we enter into September, we're less than a week away from September baseball. Lindor's got to keep this up. Lindor goes and hits 165 or 175 in September and makes a couple of errors or doesn't come up similar to yesterday in the fifth inning, more times than not, that's going to be the focus. So forget about MVP, forget about where this season ends, forget about where it lands in Mets history with war, baseball reference, all that stuff. That's what's going to be remembered. So the pressure's on. It's the go-get-it time. And if he goes out, he has a September like Piazza did in 98 and goes out and hits 350 or like Wright did down the stretch in 07 and the Mets still don't make the playoffs, I think there'll be a subset of the fan base that will blame him, which is kind of crazy. But we saw it happen with Wright too. So is that going to surprise you? It's always the most visible and vocal player where it happens. But I think ultimately, collectively, on the media side, on the fan side, I think we need to just say, hey, Francisco Lindor is a Met. He's a great Met. He's one of the leaders on this clubhouse. He may be the leader of the team, and he's going to be the face of this franchise for the most part through the remainder of his contract, and he is going to be, he was the first acquisition, big acquisition during the Cohen era, and he is, when the history books are written, he's going to be tied to those early Cohen years. And whether that leads to a championship, or especially now with Stearns at the helm and in the heart of his contract, where they're a consistent postseason contender, a team that has to be reckoned with, there's going to be a lot more than just Lindor and his play that is going to go into that. But I think right now, we all, myself included, need to get over the bad history. We need to get over the first 2 months of the season being bad. We need to get over the money in the contract. We need to get over thumbs down. We need to get over 2021. We need to get over the fact that our eyes and our history of what a leader and what a great player should be, sometimes maybe it's clouded because of the era that we grew up in. I mean, think about it. Guys like me, at my age, grew up in an era of Messier and Hernandez and Jeter, and steroid-era crazy numbers, and sports like the NBA and the NFL turning the numbers towards offense. So sometimes what a good season looks like and how it feels are two different things. Paper and emotion are two different things. Amazing. That's been the theme from the start of the show. emotion, mojo, heart, cold hard facts. Now I'm telling you, hey, you know, the numbers and the mojo have to be swung the other way. After I told you in the beginning, hey, the Mets mojo is more about cold hard facts. So that's how, funny how when that nuance of everything that we talk about, that's what this show is here for. It's us to take the nuance and the touch and the feel and the it factor and combine it with data and make a really fun, hopefully intelligent argument and opinion. All right, that's it. That's all I have for you here on this Monday afternoon lunchtime edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Started in the morning. Now it's lunchtime as I finish this show up. Couple of things. If you're a subscriber, and if you're not, you really should be, to the Talking Mets newsletter, Beyond the Mic. Going to dive into Tyler McGill, who, because Blackburn is on the DL, is probably going to get another shot. We'll dive into that. Brett Beatty, unfortunately, broke his finger, his hand. Looks like he broke his hand. He'll be out the rest of the year. We're going to dive a little bit into his future and how the Mets could evaluate him. And I'm sure along the way, it's not quite daily content, but I try to bring you 4 to 5 thoughts throughout the week to plug the gap in between the show. And anytime there's a big thing, we try to be there. Sometimes instant analysis, which, again, it's an evolving thing. It's something that is a compliment to the show. You certainly, if you don't subscribe to it, it doesn't hurt your experience with the podcast, but I'd love for you to give it a try. And I'm always, you know, there's free trials and whatnot. If you have any questions, of course, you could always reach out to me at Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, I'd love to interact with you, get you on the newsletter, get you on and get you interacting with Talking Mets, even when I'm not in front of the mic. All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silvat at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silvat at talkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, Talking Mets No G. And as I said, the newsletter, substack.com/@talkingmetsnoG. And, of course, I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.